Hey, I'm Brian Hyatt, and this is Rolling Stone Music Now. Today we're going to be talking to a giant of rock and roll, Wayne Kramer, guitarist in the MC5, who wrote a memoir called The Hard Stuff, Dope Crime, The MC5 and My Life of Impossibilities. You know, talk about a rock and roll life. Started out in the MC5, a band that wanted to change the world and, you know, overthrow the establishment, but in the end became legends but couldn't quite even make a definitive studio album, and yet inspired band after band, generation after generation of band. And afterwards, Wayne's life got pretty rough. He fell into addiction, and he actually ended up in prison for several years, where he joined the prison newspaper and learned jazz, jamming with a jazz musician, older one, who had been a lifelong heroin addict, who was also in prison. Got out of prison, moved all over the country, and continued to fight an addiction and sometimes just indulged in addiction, and made some great soul music as well. He has an album with the same title as his book, The Hard Stuff, which was on Epitaph and fell into the entire LA punk rock world there. And I think we actually have Wayne with us right now. Hello.
Hello.
Welcome to the show.
Thanks. Happy to be on the show. Where are you guys?
We're in New York here at Sirius XM, and I was running through your life, actually. I just told your entire life story, so we're good. But congrats on the book, which is intense and beautiful and really well done and harrowing at times. I'm sure it was even more harrowing to live some of this stuff.
Yeah, well, I'm happy you appreciate it. It was daunting in some senses, you know, to actually committed all to paper and try to get the sequence right and try to get, you know, what happened accurate, and to kind of, you know, analyze myself and look inward and say, well, you know, how did I really feel about, you know, what was really going on with me at that point? It's been an illuminating experience.
So you at first grew up actually on an island not that far from Detroit, and then when your parents split up, you moved to the city proper. And your first encounters with rock and roll were songs like Rebel Rouser by Duane Eddy. And I think you said that hit you right in the groin.
Yeah, there was a place where I used to stop and eat, a restaurant, the Jet Coney Island. And they had a Seaburg jukebox. And I think it had like a 15-inch speaker in it. So when those low guitar tones came out, you know, bam, boom, ga-dong, gong, 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 it was like, whoa, I can feel this music. You know? It was a physical thing.
Let's actually hear Rebel Rouser by Duane Eddy for a second.
Great.
And then it was like Chuck Berry and Little Richard. You were feeling this music more intensely than anyone around you, and you started to have a real sense that music was kind of where you needed to go with your life.
It kind of spoke to me in a secret coded language that, you know, no one else seemed to pick up on, but I was hearing loud and clear.
And when you started to form what became the MC5 or the bands that led up to it, Detroit was a thriving city with a thriving music scene. It was before the events that would change the city in a huge way. And you guys were actually playing, you know, you played some dentist fraternity party. You played all sorts of gigs in this thriving, healthy city. But then it seems like everything really started to change when the riots came, or as you call them, the revolt. Tell me about driving through the city that day and being on the roof and seeing this happen and watching the city kind of be set ablaze.
Well, yeah, I mean, ultimately it all exploded, as most of America was that summer, and people just saying, listen, we've had enough of this, and turning on their slumlords and the shopkeepers and even burning their own neighborhoods in just a rage that you could feel when you drove across the city. I mean, you could smell it. You know, the air was full of smoke and sirens and gunfire. It was kind of like a World War II Army movie, you know, where yeah. you're hearing all this in the background, except it was real. And, you know, these were streets that I grew up on and was raised and went to school and these neighborhoods I knew all my life. And now the entire order of daily life was turned upside down. It was thrilling and terrifying at the same time.
And it does seem like those events helped change the MC5 into the MC5 that the world ended up knowing. Is that oversimplifying to an extent, or is there a real connection between the wildness of the sound that eventually emerged in those events?
I think your analysis is not inaccurate. You know, having to face that kind of naked, aggressive power on the part of the police and of government agencies radicalizes one. It certainly polarizes the situation that was already volatile with the civil rights movement, with the anti-war in Vietnam movement, with oppressive 50s era sexuality and anti-marijuana laws. Young people in general felt unified in resisting the efforts of the older generation. We thought they were messing it up, and it was our duty, you know, as patriots, to try and straighten this business out. And the MC5, you know, we kind of took it personally in as much as this is my neighborhood. These are my neighbors. These are my friends. This is my family. And we're all, you know, on the receiving end of a blunt stick coming down on our heads.
And, you know, the band had obviously started with a friendship between you and Fred Smith. And there was a real kind of the kind of rock and roll we were talking about, Chuck Berry and stuff. And how did it develop on a musical level to what we hear on Kick Out the Jams? What were the steps that led from the band that could play at house parties to this monumental thing you became?
Well, I'd say it took major turns at a few different points. You know, the decision to not be a cover band exclusively was a turning point for us. You know, we were encouraged to learn songs that were played on the radio so that we could get steady employment in bars. But we didn't want to do that. I wanted to write my own songs and play concerts like my idols. You know, like The Who and The Rolling Stones. And then to the influence of the counterculture and marijuana and LSD was considerable and kind of opened my mind up to different ways of approaching music. And then ultimately to be exposed to the free jazz movement, you know, the music of John Coltrane and Sun Ra and Albert Ayler. And then trying to make a connection between what I was trying to do with the electric guitar coming from Chuck Berry to move forward to what Albert Ayler was doing with the saxophone seemed like the logical next step. So at each step of the way, our sound evolved and we escalated. Technically, we could play better. We had better equipment. And ultimately, we put all our energy into becoming the most powerful live performing band the world had ever seen. At least that was our goal. You know?
I want you right now. I think we'll play that if we can. Yeah, man. That level of distortion, where else were you hearing it? I guess Hendrix, like, where was that? Because, I mean, it was still, obviously, there's the punk element of it all, but also the heaviness was pretty fresh at that period of time. So where did the heavy come from?
It just kind of evolved. We used to play Wild Thing, and then Hendrix came out with his version of it. So we thought, well, let's move over and pick another one of their songs because we like the stuff they were doing. I think that heaviness just grew out of trying to put more energy into the same three chords. You know, where do you go once you're playing everything as fast as you possibly can? And we started to find that you could leave the beat and the key behind and go into a pure sonic dimension.
And how did the idea to make Kick Out of the Jams a live album, to kind of start out with a live album, how did that come about?
Well, it was a consensus idea between the band and Sinclair and Elektra Records, because all of our effort was put into performing live, and we had very little studio experience at that point. We had just made a handful of 45 RPM singles where you go in and you cut the song in 3 hours and mix it and you're done. And I think the idea that, you know, getting this band in a studio to record an album could be costly and labor intensive. Whereas we were fantastic live performing unit, and if we could capture the excitement of the live concert event on record, it could be a revolutionary way to introduce the band to the world. And I think that worked pretty well.
And at this point, we should probably explain the whole John Sinclair thing. Who was John Sinclair, and how did he come into the orbit of MC5?
Sure. John Sinclair was a poet, and still is a poet, the hardest working poet in show business, and remains one of my best friends. I just spoke to him last week. He ran an operation with some other artists in Detroit called the Artist Workshop. And it was a loose collection of poets and jazz musicians and writers and filmmakers and graphic artists. They had a rehearsal space in the community, and we lived in that neighborhood. We had all left home. I was 17 when I moved down there. And so I asked them if we could take advantage of the rehearsal space, and we developed a friendship. And we had great respect for John. He was a little older than us and certainly better educated, and was able to articulate in granular detail why things were the way they were in the world. Things that I knew on a gut level, he could explain in terms of, you know, this event influenced that event, or this political crisis precipitated that decision. And we grew to have enough respect for him that we asked him to manage the band, and he agreed. And he took over management of the MC5 and managed us up to the day he was sentenced to 9.5 to 10 years in prison for possession of 2 joints of marijuana.
Yeah, one of the great, insanely unjust moments of the 60s. Now he
unbelievable. It culminated with John Lennon writing a song about him, and ultimately the Michigan Supreme Court agreeing with our contention that 9.5 to 10 years for 2 joints was cruel and unusual punishment and a violation of the U.S. Constitution.
Now, John had formed a sort of sister group to the Black Panthers called the White Panther, and the official ethos was rock and roll, dope, and fucking in the streets was the platform. You guys consider yourself White Panthers as well, or were you kind of just, how did you see that on a sort of membership basis?
Absolutely. We were founding members of the party. I was a minister of culture in the streets.
Right.
Was my title. You know, it was in the beginning, it was kind of a semi-serious way to express solidarity with the Black Panther Party and to express our frustration with the slow pace of change. You know, we saw the great injustices that in the world around us, and being young and being extremely idealistic, we wanted to do something about it. We wanted to make a difference. And I think one person can make a difference. I think 5 people can make an incredible difference. I think 12 people could do phenomenal things if they're organized and focused. And so the White Panthers became a delivery system to send a message to America that, we wanted things to change.
Even if you didn't know that about you guys, you could hear it in the music. So John Sinclair, he had that line about he wanted you to be bigger than Mao. You know, he didn't see you as just a rock and roll band. He really saw you as a force for revolution, which you did too. But at the same time, you wanted to be a great and big and successful rock and roll band. Is that fair to say as well?
That is fair to say.
One of the things that is really interesting in the book, and there's a lot of things we won't have time to get to at all. But if you guys want to know it all, you're going to have to read the book. But I will say it's kind of a famous thing. It's when you were playing in New York and the group known as the Motherfuckers felt that you guys were insufficiently revolutionary and really flipped out when Elektra, your label, sent a limo to pick you up after the gig. And all hell broke loose, right?
Yeah, it was... It was quite a dramatic scene. I mean, you know, maybe they should have sent an armored personnel carrier to pick us up, or a tank or something. But that the limo symbolized everything about the pig honky culture that the motherfuckers and we all on the hard left oppose. You know, Elektra just thought they were doing a nice thing by sending a car to pick us up from the gig. But as usual, the business interests were a step behind what was happening in the street. And they ended up, you know, with a terrible confrontation with me out in the middle of the street at midnight trying to argue political polemics with, you know, a bunch of crazed speed freaks and junkies and drunken, you know, street people. And you know, I almost got killed. Finally, the leaders of the motherfuckers came in, and one of them came on the front of me and one came on the back, and they literally carried me out of the crowd like a sandwich, protecting my body from the crowd, and walked a few blocks away from the Fillmore when it, you know, it was down on 2nd Avenue and 6th Street, I think.
Yeah, now there's a really good barbecue restaurant right over there. Things have changed.
Fantastic.
But they have a little plaque for the Fillmore East, they do. But this conflict between changing the world and just being a great rock and roll band kept manifesting itself. Before we move on to your second album, a couple things. It's quite an incredible piece of history. The obviously you guys played outside the 1968 Democratic Convention. What was that day like?
It was not unlike a lot of days for the MC5, because we would play anywhere anyone would let us. And to play a free concert in a park for community groups was something we did as a matter of course. And so when Jerry Rubin and Abby Hoffman invited us to Chicago to perform at the Festival of Life to oppose the Festival of Death, which is the way they saw the Democrats' convention, we jumped at the chance. Sure, they said all the California bands were coming, and bands were coming from all over the world, and it was going to be a big rock festival. And so we drove out there and got there. There was no stage. There was no electricity. There was no flatbed truck. There was nothing. So we set up on the ground, and we had to borrow electrical power from a hot dog stand to run our back line. And we performed a set, and the minute we finished, and I'd seen this before, when as long as the band is playing or the crowd has something positive to focus on, everything is fairly peaceful. But once you take that away, the mob mentality takes over. And of course, the Chicago police were provoking the kids by really rough tactic, you know, beating kids and pushing kids around and riding their motorcycles through the crowd. And of course, you know, the kids responded in kind, and we got in our van and headed back to Detroit where we'd be safe. And then we all watched on television as what happened as the Chicago police went on a rampage and beat young people indiscriminately on national television. And it was a stirring moment in America.
Yeah, yeah, and like you said, it does feel there's some resonances right now. We'll see just how much. But you are not necessarily a super fan of Kick Out the Jams. You are, however, playing what sounds like a really exciting tour starting in September, where you're going to be performing that album in its entirety with a sort of super group with people like Soundgarden's Kim Thayil. And so that's exciting. But when it comes to the album itself, I think you think that it was sort of not a great night for the band, right? You actually feel that it could have been documented on a different, better night, and you would have preferred that?
That is how I feel. I mean, you know, I want to be honest, and, you know, I don't want to, you know, I abhor revisionism. And, you know, my feeling at the time was, geez, this wasn't a really great gig for us. We should record it again. And my vote was not enough to carry the day. And the consensus was that the record sounds great. We're going to go with it. But yeah, I would have preferred to keep recording and getting a night where we played a little better. You know, the band was mercurial, and on a good night, we were unbelievable. But on a bad night, we could be kind of a train wreck. And I didn't think that was one of our better shows. But you're right, you know, to go out today, 50 years later, and perform that album with guys like Kim Thayil and Brendan Canty, the great Fugazi drummer, and Marcus Durant, the Zangorilla singer, and Billy Gould, the bass player from Faith No More, to play with musicians of this caliber who, believe me, they get it right every night. They play the stuff real. They really take it seriously, and the music is just sounding incredible. You know, the MC5 actually never sounded this good. But, you know, today, listen, we've all been playing for a long time now, and you know, I made that record. I was 19 years old, and I was pretty crazy. I mean, I'm still fairly crazy, but I've been around a little while, and I know how to play the guitar a bit, and so do my coworkers. And the sound has really just been inspiring every night to go out and play these songs and see the reaction in a whole new generation of music fans that never heard this music before. It's very exciting for me. It's a gift that I never asked for and never expected, but I really appreciate.
Yeah, I can't wait to see that. The fascinating thing to me is that Michael Davis, the bass player in MC5, that he said that he essentially like was playing out of sheer intuition. Like he might not know, wasn't really playing with chord progressions. It almost sounded like he almost wasn't a musician the way you describe it.
That's not inaccurate. You know, he could play the acoustic guitar, and him and I used to sing folk songs together and, you know, harmonize Beatles songs and Temptations harmony parts. And I loved to sing with him. And then when it looked like the bass player in the band was going to leave, I thought, well, let me just move Michael over into the band and I'll show him, you know, how to play the bass. And that was naive of me to think that anybody could be a great bass player or that I could create a great bass player, because I can't do that. And we all play the instruments or do what we do based on something deep inside, a motivation that's internal. And Michael just kind of went from being a, you know, art student to the bass player in the MC5 in one smooth lateral move. And I thought it was a good thing for a long time because his approach was unencumbered by convention.
So to speak, yeah.
But yeah, as time went on and we had to learn how to work in a recording studio and, you know, we had to try to be consistent with our performances, it turned out to be a little bit of a liability because, you know, there were fundamental rules of the road that Michael hadn't mastered yet. And so, you know, it made the band a uniquely idiosyncratic.
Let's hear Come Together from Kick Out the Jams, if we can.
Great.
Yeah. I mean, Lester Bangs pointed out, and as anyone with ears can point out, there was a similarity to I Can See for Miles by The Who, of course.
Sure.
But, you know,
we were influenced by the world we lived in. You know, we were very plugged into what was going on around us.
So you made this album. You then wanted to make a real studio album. You ended up in the studio with John Landau, who later became manager and producer for Bruce Springsteen. And the album was Back in the USA. And, you know, there's actually great stuff on Back in the USA. And there's moments of really great rock and roll. And the rap on it, at least in the U.S., the critical rap was that it kind of was too restrained. It went too far in the other direction, that it was too tight, too clean. I think you said this yourself in the book, and it just kind of missed the mark in that way. That said, if you listen to something like The Human Being Lawnmower, it still is pretty cool. I actually have a theory about Back in the USA, which is it starts out with your version of Tutti Frutti, which is pretty tame, and I think that maybe that helped poison people's ideas of the album. What do you think?
I don't disagree with you. It's easy to be Monday morning quarterbacks, you know.
40 years later, yeah.
40 years later, but yeah, I think we were extremists. So we went from one extreme to the other. We were extremely improvisational and undisciplined, to being extremely controlled and kind of clamped down. what drove me was I wanted to answer our critics who said that we couldn't play and that, you know, we were kind of a fraud, you know, the revolutionary hype. And when I knew in my heart that this was a great rock and roll band and could had the potential to be the archetypal American hard rock group and really usher in a new era of hard American rock and roll that had a relevance that was, you know, connected to the concerns of young people.
And the irony is that the British punks, as much as that record kind of missed in America, it turned out all the future British punks absolutely loved Back in the USA. So that was kind of the twist on that. But let's hear Human Being Lawnmower if we can, just to get a sense of that.
Sure.
So again, I think the reputation for overly tamed could be exaggerated, especially if you pull out a track like that. But one of the things I thought was interesting is John Lando, after becoming so spectacularly successful, I think attracted a lot of resentment. And I think people always wanted to, quote unquote, blame him for the cleanness of this album. I really got a sense from this book that was as much your idea for the album as his. He wasn't trying to tame MC5. It was more of an internal idea.
Yeah, I mean, and the truth is he could not have forced anyone to do anything. You know, we were so defiant and rebellious that, you know, had someone come in and tried to tell us how to do something, it just would have never worked. We listened to John. John, you know, is a brilliant man and has a clean and clear vision of how rock and roll works from the inside out. And we've seen it expressed successfully in his work with Bruce Springsteen, that, you know, they were able to identify core themes and core musical ideas that built Bruce's career. And a lot of those, I think, were ideas that we pioneered in the MC5, but the MC5 was too unmanageable to execute with. You know, he tried to, This was a consensus effort. And in fact, you know, John Sinclair is the guy who recommended John Landau produce the album.
Right.
So, you know, even though it did alienate some of our core constituency in the Detroit area, it helped build our following internationally. And it was a great music lesson in how to work in the studio. So by the time we got to the third MC5 album, High Time, we knew how to work in the studio and we knew how to minimize our weaknesses and focus on our strengths and how to be creative in the studio environment.
And at the same time, your label, the music industry started to just turn its back on you in a really classic and awful case of once the industry shuts off that faucet of money and interest in you, you just hit a brick wall. And there's a moment when you go to Ahmet Ertegun and ask for more money and he says, we have an expression about good money after bad. Then he took a phone call and started talking in French and then turned the chair away from you. And that was pretty much it, right?
That was it. Yeah, it was... The symbolism, the poetry of the moment was unmistakable, you know, like, you know, they didn't really have a grip on what to do with a white rock band like the MC5 to begin with. They were, you know, an R&B specialty label, but they saw that there was going to be a lot of money in these rock and roll bands, these white guitar driven bands. So, you know, they signed the most formidable of all of them, the MC5. Then they tried to figure out what to do with us. And, you know, we were uncontrollable and we had no, Sinclair had gone to prison. We had tried to work with establishment music business professionals. And of course, that didn't work. This, you know, this kind of hitting a brick wall at every turn ultimately led to the band imploding. You got to remember that the MC5 never pulled the golden horseshoe out of our ass. You know, we never had a hit record. Most of the bands that emerge and that sustain, they generally have hit records right out of the box. You know, The Who, their first records were hits. The Rolling Stones' first records were hits. U2's first records were hits. REM, you know, Rage Against the Machine, all these bands had hit records right out of the box. And that provides the cash flow that keeps bands afloat when times get tough.
Right.
And the MC5 never had that cash flow. And, you know, we've got mouths to feed, and we're starting to, people are getting married and having children, and the center never holds. And the way things were when we started the band in 1966 and 67 isn't where we were at in 1972. And, of course, the music business, the record industry in particular, in those days was growing exponentially every year with higher profits and more records being sold. All they cared about was commercial success. And the MC5 was just a load of problems for them, between our problems with the police and the FBI, and then problems in our own community with not being revolutionary enough for the revolution. I mean, these were ideas that were way too complex for record company guys to want to deal with. You know, so they signed a bunch of new bands that, you know, just wanted to be rock stars. And that was the smart move for them. Unfortunately, it signaled the end of any business support for the MC5.
Before we move on from the early years real quick, we were talking about being dropped from record labels and fighting with the business. I mean, an example of how the MC5 conducted themselves on a business level is when the department store Hudson's banned you guys. And you actually ran a ad in the underground magazine Fifth Estate and in the Ann Arbor Argus that said, "Kick out the jams, motherfucker, and kick in the door if the store won't sell you the album on Elektra. Fuck Hudson's." And then Hudson's went on to ban everything on Elektra. So that might help explain that. We start to understand why the label might have had a problem with you guys, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, they didn't. They didn't see our thinking. They didn't follow our logic and in the stance we were taking. That you know, like if you let people run over you, then you know you kind of get what your hand calls for. They said we had complete control over our marketing, and that's how we decided to respond to being banned, especially from a store that we had all shopped at all our lives. You know, that store was an institution in Detroit, and for them to not carry our record because they thought that the content was obscene, you know, that's not their call to make. And in America, we have something called freedom of expression. And the label, in fact, told us they would back us in a freedom of expression legal case if it came to that. But you know, when it started to affect their bottom line, they changed their mind and fired us.
Now, things got rough after the end of the band. I was thinking about this. I mean, there's a lot of musicians who cultivate an image of being out on the edge. And I mean, you were far on the edge. You were seriously into crime and you got caught fairly red-handed. They actually came into your apartment and saw a bunch of stolen goods there and you went to prison. And it was no joke.
As a gangster, I make a great guitar player. I'm a complete failure as a criminal. I had no idea what I was doing, and you know, like, but when I went to prison, they taught me how to do crime. I learned in prison how to deal drugs and how to do robberies and how to do a lot of stuff that's, you know, extremely antisocial.
Yeah.
Negative.
Yeah.
And this prison's good for that. Prison is crime school.
At the same time, you learned a lot about jazz thanks to an old jazz musician who'd spent a lot of time in prison because of his opiate addiction.
Yeah, Red Rodney was his name, and Red was from the bebop era of jazz, and he replaced Miles Davis in the Charlie Parker Quintet. And he played with a degree of accomplishment that is still unseen in trumpeters today. I mean, he was a phenomenal artist. When he played his horn, I didn't hear notes or chords or scales. I smelled fried chicken and you know, felt the rain on 52nd Street, you know. I mean, his playing was so vivid and so alive and so deep. That, that was an unexpected gift to become his student and to become his friend and serve time with him and study music and play together in the prison band. So I went in, you know, a fairly adventurous rock guitar player, and I think I came out of prison a competent musician.
And, you know, you spent time in the wilderness, you spent time dealing with addiction, but then in 1995, you hooked up with Epitaph and released The Hard Stuff. It's such a great album. You were just ready to make a great album at that point in time, and that must have been a good feeling when you came out with that, getting recognition from a new generation, I imagine.
Well, yeah, I mean, we've all heard there are no second acts in America, but, you know, I've had a second act, a third act, a fourth act. to have the backing of a great company like Epitaph and Brett Gurewitz, and to be able to make records for his company and go out and promote them and play music for people around the world was a great turn of events for me, and, you know, to finally figure out that there was a way to live without, you know, where drugs and alcohol were not necessary every day, and that that I could have a productive and useful life, and then ultimately, you know, to found Jail Guitar Doors and be able to go back to prison and help prisoners through the skills that I have in music. And, you know, to have I have a 5-year-old son that I am absolutely in love with. I adore him, and a wonderful wife who supports my efforts. I've got very little to complain about at this stage of the game. I'm a fortunate man.
Yeah, man. And that's another reason this is a satisfying book. So thanks so much for being with us. So that was Wayne Kramer, who has a new book called The Hard Stuff, Dope Crime, The MC5, and My Life of Impossibilities. And he also has a tour this fall where he's going to be playing Kick Out the Jams in its entirety. And this has been today's Rolling Stone Music Now. We'll be back next week here on SiriusXM's Volume, Channel 106. We are a podcast. Download us wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe to us as a podcast. Maybe leave us a review on iTunes. And in the meantime, we'll be back next week. And as always, thanks for listening.